Welcome to Pound the Rock, the Scores NBA podcast, after a two-week hiatus. My name is Joseph Cacciaro, and I'm here with co-host Joe Wolfo.
After a two-week hiatus, your name is...
I was wondering if my name changed in the last 2 weeks.
Well, that's... I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. Given the number of things that have changed in the NBA over... this is why we can't take breaks, man. Because too much has happened. There's a bunch of stuff that I feel like we're not even going to get around to talking about today, because we won't have time. And as it is, I'm sure we're going to be pushing our 80-minute hard-out limit. But just a ton of news and storylines and goings-on in the world of the NBA over the last couple weeks. So,
well, let's get to some of it right away. Let's not waste any time here. I think structure of today's show, we are going to spend time in both conferences. We're going to be in the Eastern Conference trying to figure out who is the second best in the conference. And then we're going to go to the West and talk about just that absolutely batshit crazy playoff race. Two very different conferences, but things to talk about in both. The reason the East is so muddied at the top is injuries, or at least injuries have played a big part in them. I mean, if you just kind of take different segments of the year, early in the year when, you know, the Harden-less Sixers got off to the start they got off to, and Maxey was playing the way he was, and Embiid was looking like he was going to walk to a second straight MVP, having the best scoring season ever, we thought, hey, the Sixers look like they're finally maybe ready to do this. And even if ready to do this doesn't mean to win a title or make the finals, maybe they'll make the conference finals, which they haven't done since 2001. I think they did look like the second best team in the East to start the year. Embiid gets hurt. He's back now, and we can talk about that, but they obviously had fallen from that perch of like, okay, we think this is the second best team after Boston. The Bucks have had their moments throughout the season, and for the most part have pretty consistently been the second place team all season, but there are obviously a lot of reasons to question what's going on there. I mean, they just lost to the goddamn Wizards and Skeleton Grizzlies on back-to-back nights, and yes, I know last night Dame and Middleton were both out, but the starting lineup of the Grizzlies that beat them combined makes less than Giannis will make this year. So, like, even without Dame and Middleton, still a crazy... I think the Bucks were still favored by 11 or 12 and a half. So, still a terrible loss, 24 hours after another terrible loss. You've got Doc Rivers out here talking about the team's road woes. Did you see this quote, by the way, Wolfon, when Doc Rivers talked about the team's road woes?
Yeah, blaming the traveling crew. That crew is catching a ton of strays this year, man.
From Giannis. And
Giannis
Doc
calling out the equipment manager.
What Doc said is, I've actually been sitting back and watching everything. Not just our players, but our travel crew. Everything. And I've made a lot of notes. We don't bring the necessary professionalism, seriousness on the road. And that's something we can fix. And that's something we're going to have to fix. Well, I got news for you, Doc. There's about 2 weeks left in the regular season and then the playoffs. And there's a lot of pressure on this team to win. So if you truly believe you've pinpointed the reasons for these road woes, you better get on them. But anyway, yeah, the Bucks, just since hiring Doc, other than these losses to the Wizards and twice to the Skeleton Grizzlies, they lost twice to the Bronless Lakers, lost to the Jazz, I believe without Markkanen, and have lost to the Blazers. Now, of course, they also have wins over the Thunder, Wolves, and Nuggets during that time. But again, just a very confounding season in Milwaukee, to the point where even though they've been second place all year, I do not think they're deserving of us saying this is clearly the second best team in the East. We've talked about Philly. The Knicks, the biggest news today revolves around the Knicks, because now they have officially lost Julius Randle for the season. Huge bummer. You and I have both talked, you know, about how even though Julius Randle's game will never be the most aesthetically pleasing, the guy had gone to a point in his career where he just gets it done. Like, the results end up being there, and he's helped the Knicks become a pretty solid team over the last couple of years. And as I've talked about, I thought this team was healthy, especially after the deadline moves. They were my second best team in the East, a team I thought could make the conference finals. Talked about how I thought this was now like the best Knicks team of the 21st century and the closest thing to a real contender New York has had. And it is such a goddamn shame that we're never going to know if that was the case or not, because Julius Randle's done for the year. So another team where it's like, okay, they might have been the second, but no, they're not. They can't be. Cleveland, who I think you had maybe picked them to finish with the number one, right? Or like top two. I thought they definitely could hang in that race all year. I thought they were at the very least built for regular season excellence. And they had that run where they got really hot, survived some injuries, and then very much looked like, oh, now, okay, this is the second best team in the East. They're 11-15 over their last 26 games. Donovan Mitchell calling the team out, including himself. I don't want to mean it like he's calling just the team out, not himself. He included himself in that, but he called the Cavs out recently, and I think his exact wording was, it's fucking April, as if to say, like, yo, it's, you know, we got to get going here. So I know I just took 4 minutes, but that's kind of the state of it right now, and that's why we are having this discussion we're about to have today, where it's like, okay, who is the second best team in the East? Because all these teams have major questions, and it's like, I don't know, Wolf. You tell me, who do you think is the second best team in the East? Is it the Bucks by default just because of all the things we've talked about with these other teams?
I do think so. Like, I think that if I'm handicapping it, to me, the Bucks are still the most likely team to get to the conference finals and the most likely Eastern Conference team to beat Boston in a series. I just think you have to give them that. I mean, not only because they literally are the second best team by record in the East right now, and because Giannis is by far the best player in the group that we're talking about. Although, well, maybe not by far if we're talking about like a fully operational Embiid, but Embiid in the state that he's in as he ramps back up, I think you say, you know, having Giannis is preferable. So, yeah, I think if I had to choose, I would give that nod to the Bucks, but as you laid out, they've just been such a confounding team all season. I mean, when have we talked about them on this pod this year when it's just been overwhelmingly positive? Just a straight breakdown of like all the things that are going right for them. I don't think a single time. I think every time we talk about them, it's mainly confusion or disappointment, you know, just like they fired their coach midseason, even though they were 31-13 at the time. Like, it's just for a team that is ostensibly sitting in a pretty good spot, being second in the East with, I think, a 2-game lead or a game and a half lead on third. Like, they should be feeling pretty good about themselves, like, especially given that, you know, Chris Middleton has missed like, what, 25 games or so. So, like, yep. You can look at the, like, all the overlying stuff and be, I guess, encouraged about where they're at. But I think anyone who's watched this team on a consistent basis this year understands that it hasn't been nearly that simple. And, like, you know, you laid out their recent stretch of games where it's like they have that amazing, dominant win over the Thunder, which was maybe their single best defensive game of the year. And their defense definitely is better. Like, since Doc took over, since the All-Star break, I think they're 12th in the NBA. But it still has holes and lapses that show up at various times. And so they have that win over the Thunder, and then immediately they blow a 19-point fourth-quarter lead against the LeBron-less Lakers and lose that game in double overtime. They follow that up with what I thought was a very underwhelming loss to the Pelicans without Brandon Ingram, in which the Bucks only scored like 100 points and had some very mystifying offensive process, I thought. Like, totally let Zion off the hook on defense in that game. I think in those two games, at least, they were pretty much fully healthy. Then they beat the Hawks, which is like, you know, fine. The Hawks are actually pretty plucky these days, so that's a decent win, I guess. And then the losses that you're talking about, where they lose to the Wizards. And, like, yeah, Dame didn't play in that game, but, like, come on. You know, I think that's still a game you have to win. And then they lose to the Grizzlies with no Dame or Middleton. So that is definitely a more excusable loss, but still not great considering that in that game, the Grizzlies were playing a 9-man rotation of Trey Jemison, Scottie Pippen Jr., Luke Kennard, Gigi Jackson, Jaren Jackson, Jordan Goodwin, Jake LaRavia, Lamar Stevens, and Brandon Clark. Like, again, the Bucks didn't have their second or third best player in that game, and yet I still think that qualifies as a pretty disappointing loss. So they're one of these teams, and there are many of these teams, and like, it's kind of a theme of this season, I feel like, just the roller coaster nature of it and how many of these teams there still are that are hard to figure out. Like, we can talk about the Suns later, who are, I feel like, kind of in a similar boat, but like, I just don't, I don't know what to make of them. Because, like, yes, that defense is definitely better, but the offense has struggled. Like, the offense has not gotten up to the level it was at earlier in the season. And part of that is that Dame, while he has had some great moments, by his standards, has really struggled at the offensive end this year. And there's been a lot of talk about how under Doc Rivers, they've leaned a lot more heavily into the Dame Giannis two-man game. But like, you know, and that has had some success, but like, what has it amounted to on the whole? Like, I don't think that's actually like spamming Dame Giannis pick and roll, which is what the Bucks did at the end of that game against the Lakers that they lost, hasn't actually worked all that well. And like, there are moments like early in that game, they had an unbelievable possession where they're like racing the ball up the floor. Giannis has it. He's looking to go into like a DHO game with Lillard, but the Lakers kind of take that away. So what Giannis does is he throws it ahead to Brook Lopez, who's kind of coming up out of the corner. Brook takes it, immediately swings it back to Giannis, who does a pitch back to Dame, who's now created a bit of separation. They turn that into a pick and roll. Dame hits Giannis on the short roll, and he whips it out to the opposite wing to Malik Beasley for a three. And they did that in like the span of 4 seconds. It was like run with a ton of pace and purpose and like stuff like that. They can look really, really good and really scary offensively, but they don't do that nearly enough. And then you also have the fact that Malik Beasley has gone into like a real shooting slump. And as we've talked about a lot, if he's not shooting the ball well, then, you know, how much is he really contributing?
Yeah. Get ready to bench, buddy.
Well, I don't think he will, because who are they going to replace him with, man? Like, I know you've advocated for starting Beverly, but I don't think that's actually the answer for them.
Again, I didn't come at it that way from a standpoint of like, I think Patrick Beverly is a starting guard on a contender. I came at it from that vantage point of, given what you lose on the defensive end with Malik Beasley in a backcourt with Damian Lillard and how much that is going to compromise you in the playoffs, and given the offensive abilities of this team, irrespective of Malik Beasley and the shooting and obviously all the stuff game brings, I feel like you are much better balanced and built for the playoffs with Beverly beside Dame as opposed to Malik Beasley.
I just think they need Beasley's spacing even more than they need Pat Bev's point of attack defense in that starting lineup.
And which is crazy.
It is, but that's where they're at. And like, even that's the thing about Beasley. Like, even if he isn't knocking down his threes, which he's still at 42% for the season, by the way. Like, that should tell you, the fact that he's in a slump and is still at 42% from three should tell you how red hot he was from deep early in the year. But even when he's not knocking down his threes, he's still commanding defensive attention in a way that Pat Beverly obviously is not. So, and I actually think that both him and Dame, as part of this team-wide defensive improvement, which, as I've said before, I think is primarily driven by Giannis just getting back up to his all-defensive caliber level, I think those guys have both been better during this stretch too. And that's important, because a lot of what they're doing, like, they need their guards to be able to get over screens. They need them to X out on the weak side. They need them to, when they're late switching, do the thing where they're veering back and like getting into the big man's legs on the roll, or like executing that with enough precision. You know, if you're switching and there are gaps there, then the switching's not going to work. I think they've done a really good job. Not a really good job. They've done a much better job of that in the last few weeks. So I give them credit. But like, yeah, that's, I don't know where to come down on this, because Giannis has been amazing. Like, I thought he had like a pretty rough first month of the season, rough 6 weeks of the season even. And since then, he's been pretty much the best version of Giannis, I think, that we've seen. Like, unstoppable on offense, has gotten back to close to his peak level on defense. And there are certain nights where he's had to carry them, which was not supposed to happen when they got Dame Lillard. But Dame hasn't been, I don't think, the kind of co-star that they imagined him to be or hoped that he would be. Like, it's a lot of it has fallen on Giannis a lot of the times, obviously at both ends of the floor.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, Brook's been great all year, but I think he's also had like a bit of slippage defensively in the last little while that Giannis has sort of had to make up for.
Which honestly is fair, given that had the best defensive season of his career last year at in his mid-30s. So I think it was like fair to expect he could still be really good, but just not that good defensively.
Yeah. Yeah, and he is still very good.
Right.
But, you know, he's very good at the specific things that he is very good at. And so, not that, like, I think I've said before, I think he is probably a slightly more versatile defender than people give him credit for, but it still ultimately just comes down to like the drop coverage and the rim protection for him. And if that slips even a little bit, then that makes a big difference because you're mostly only playing him in that type of coverage. And I do think there's been some slippage there for him over the last few weeks. So that's kind of the thing with the Bucks, right? Is like, it's sort of not to the extent with like some other teams that we will talk about later, but one thing rises and another always seems to like fall in conjunction. And so they always wind up being around the same team that we've seen from the start of the year. Offense good, defense bad, defense better, offense worse, like guards better defensively, big slightly, you know what I mean? Like it's like the even Steven thing. Although obviously they're like, you know, they're 47 and 29 or something. So they're better than even, but like, you know what I mean? I wanted to know kind of overall what you have made of Middleton. Because I think a lot's been made of him coming back and how he sort of completes the team, which, you know, like obviously that's true. And I think something that I've said from the start of the year is as much as everybody, including me coming into the year, was imagining this devastating Dame Giannis two-man game being the bread and butter of Milwaukee's offense, it's actually been like the Dame Brooke Lopez pick and roll and the Middleton Giannis pick and roll that have been, I think, their most effective actions. So him being back and like being able to pair up with Giannis in two-man game and just be like another creator that they can rely on down the stretch of games has been huge. A lot's been made of like the Bucks numbers with all four of Dame, Middleton, Giannis, Lopez on the floor together. What have you made of how he's looked overall and especially since he's gotten back from that injury?
I've been really encouraged. You know, as much as we're kind of dumping on this up and down season of the Bucks, I've been really encouraged by what Middleton's looked like since he got back. Specifically, sometime in March, mid-March maybe, he had missed that time. Before that, he looked like an absolute shell of himself, was not moving well, did not look like the kind of player that could, you know, bump this team's ceiling up to where it could be. Since he came back in March, I think he's looked a lot more like the Chris Middleton of old. Just this week, he's had a couple really good games. Like even in that terrible loss they had to the Wizards, I think he looks a lot more like the player the Bucks hoped to have in him this year since he came back in March. And I think that's a huge boon for their offense. Like defensively, I still don't think he's the player he once was, but he's not like a sieve defensively. You know, they have much. Oh, you look like you might be thinking he's a sieve now defensively. I don't think he's a great defensive.
Sieve adjacent.
Wow.
He's borderline sieve-like on like, defense.
I agree he is not a good defender. And even at his best, his defense was probably a little overblown. But really? You're going that far? Sieve adjacent? It is bad, but is it that bad?
He's just... I feel this way about him offensively, too. And it just doesn't matter because he has like the sort of fluidity of self-creation and the things that he can do with the ball in his hands as a playmaker and as a shooter are able to overcome this, but he just looks slow to me.
That I agree
think,
with.
I think that's affecting him defensively more than it's affecting him offensively. Offensively, you know, he can run the pick and roll, he can operate out of the post, he can do all these things to, you know, especially in the half court, kind of mask his waning athleticism, but it's harder to hide that at the defensive end. I've said this before too, like I just think even on like apart from the physical limitations and like the way that age and injuries are maybe catching up to him, it's like some weird mental miscues, man. And I know those two things can be linked a lot of the time. Like
yeah.
Trust your body, then that can affect you mentally as well. But just like a lot of instances where, and you don't know actually who to blame in some of these situations, right? Where there's a coverage breakdown. One guy thinks it's a switch. The other guy thinks they're staying. And so two guys end up going with the ball or going with the screener and somebody pops wide open without knowing like what the coverage is actually supposed to be in that situation or who was supposed to communicate if there was an audible to that coverage. Like you don't know whether to point the finger at Middleton in all of those situations, but when there is a pattern, which I feel like there has been with him,
yeah,
you start to notice, like, man, like, that's another coverage breakdown that a veteran player like Middleton should not be making. Like, and again, he wasn't involved in all of these, but down the stretch of that game against the Lakers, it was a lot of the Lakers just like running guard actions that the Bucks were having a weirdly hard time defending. And Middleton was involved in a few of those, while also he had a putrid offensive game in that one. So there's a lack of consistency there with him. And I just, as much as it's obviously great for the Bucks that he is back and generally playing pretty well offensively, like, his numbers are actually, you know, 56% from 2-point range, 38% from deep, 20 points and 7 assists per 36 minutes. Like, those are good numbers.
This is the best playmaking stretch of his career.
Yeah.
He's averaging like 7 assists a game, not even per 36, a game since he came back in March. He's averaging about 17 points and 7 assists on solid efficiency.
There's just something about it that I don't trust, like, that's watching fair. Him. It doesn't, the numbers, the production doesn't fully match the eye test for me. So if we're talking about him as like the piece that is supposed to complete the championship puzzle for the Bucks, I don't think I'm sold.
Okay, let's look at it this way then. And not just about Milwaukee, I'm talking about the East overall. Given everything we've discussed with the Bucks and everything we've seen from the Bucks over the season. So we're both kind of in agreement that they are the second best team by default, especially because of what's going on around them with the other teams that are kind of fighting for that second best title. Out of the other teams in the East playoff picture, who would you say is best equipped to derail what otherwise looks like an inevitable Celtics-Bucks collision course? Like, if there's a team in the East where you say, this team is well equipped to beat Milwaukee in a playoff series and therefore will stop this collision, like, is it Miami again?
I was going to say, I already know who you're going to say.
No, listen, I think if Embiid's healthy, I think the Sixers are the answer.
I mean, if OG gets back, I kind of think it's the Knicks, even without Randall. Like, I don't know what the status of OG is. I know Josh Hart had that quote where he was like, yeah, if Randall and OG make it back this year, I'll be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
So that doesn't bode well. But, like, if you had asked me before this Randall news came out, you can only pick one of these guys to come back for the playoffs, who would you want as the Knicks? I would have said OG.
That's fair.
I think they're in better shape with him healthy versus if Randall had been able to make it back and OG was still out. Like, I think if OG makes it back, they can still be formidable and still cause a lot of headaches for the Bucks and potentially beat them in a series. That's how I feel. Because Brunson, I know it's different in the playoffs when defenses are going to key in on him to like a different extent, but man, he's looked pretty damn good taking on that much more playmaking responsibility with Randall out of the lineup. Like, he has just taken on. Jared Dubin had like a great breakdown of all the different, like, the increases in all the different actions for Jalen Brunson. On ball, off ball, DHOs, every single thing that you can imagine offensively, he's had to scale up. And the production, the efficiency has still very much been there. So he's been able to take that on. And I think if you're looking at it in that context and you have a guy who can be this kind of heliocentric offensive operator, who do you want to surround him with? OG fits that archetype way better than Randall does. And especially if you think about the types of players that he would be asked to defend in a playoff series, like, it's just, you can't overstate the potential impact of him making it back if he can do so. So that's a huge if, but if OG makes it back, I think, like, what you're getting offensively from Brunson, what you're getting offensively from DiVincenzo, who, like, what a season, what a pickup. He's been so good. You know, Mitchell Robinson is back now. He is coming off the bench. Hartenstein is still starting. Hartenstein's been amazing. I think that's probably how the Knicks will keep it, I think, in terms of, like, they'll probably keep starting Hartenstein, right?
I would imagine, yeah, based on the way it's looked so far.
And there's this other thing. And I guess this is, maybe if the playoffs were going to be officiated this way anyway, it doesn't actually wind up making that big of a difference. But I feel like, and we can talk about this with Miami too, because I think it affects them as well. But if you're looking at a team that has benefited from the new points of emphasis in the officiating, in terms of allowing a little bit more contact on drives, not giving drivers as much of the benefit of the doubt, letting more contact go and swallowing their whistles, this very physical defensive-oriented Knicks team has benefited from that a lot. And again, like the playoffs, maybe we're just going to be officiated that way anyway, but like I think they're a team, if there is like a little bit more freedom of physicality, they're a team that can benefit from that. But to your point, so can Miami. And one of the things I was looking at with Miami is the last few years under Spo, they're always a team that forces a ton of turnovers. They defend very physically and very aggressively. Despite being like a switchable team, like the Celtics are very switchable and they consistently rank near the bottom of the league. I think they're 30th this year in forcing turnovers. The Heat, who are actually, as I've mentioned before, a lot less switchable this year than they've been in the past. They're playing Bam and drop way more than they ever have before. He's not switching out a ton, but generally they like to switch a lot, but they switch with physicality and they switch and double and they trap, like they fly around. And this year they are 7th in the league in opponent turnover percentage, but they're 4th in suppressing opponent free throw attempt rate. And that, to be able to strike that balance, is really impressive and really important for your defense. They were good at that last year as well, but if you take it back to 2 years ago, they were 2nd in forcing opponent turnovers, but 27th in opponent free throw attempt rate. So the fact that they've managed to maintain this kind of physical defensive identity, but doing it now without fouling, is huge. And that's a reason, you know, like I've never had any qualms or doubts about Miami's defense.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if we're picking like two teams that I think could, you know, spoil that Bucks Celtics conference finals, I think it's probably Miami. Well, and then you throw Philly into that mix too, right? But like, again, it's like very contingent on health with both New York and Philly.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I kind of see it is like, okay, who's the second best team in the East? If you went by the questions facing all the other teams and the top tier talent, it's still the Fugazi Bucks by default. If you went by potential and ceiling, if things like guys get back from injury, whatever, it's one of the Sixers or Knicks. If you went by track record and who to trust in the spring, it's the Heat. If you went by just who's kind of consistently been there all season, not in the number two slot, but just like consistently been there, good all year. They had maybe one little dip, but they've survived some injuries, elite defense. It could be the Orlando Magic. Now, I don't actually believe that. They can't score enough to keep up. But I do wonder, like, if that team was not wearing Orlando Magic jerseys and they are having the season they're having with that elite defense. Again, yes, an offense that struggles, but a couple guys that, you know, can be tough shot creators and makers from the areas of the floor that, you know, you're going to get shots in the playoffs. Is that a team that you could see maybe making that surprise run to the conference finals a la the 2021 Hawks? Like, or are the offensive struggles there just too much for you to ignore? Like, forget the youth and, again, the fact that, oh, it's the Magic and they don't belong here yet. Like, just strictly by what they are as a basketball team right now.
I can't get there.
Okay. Because we are talking about just, like, we're talking about a team that's probably going to settle on, like, 48, 49 wins, is very much in the race for the number three seed, and again, has the second best defense in the league. But the 23rd,
they're only two games behind the Bucks for the number two seed.
There you go.
It's a couple things. It's the offense, and it's also the fact that I think a lot of their success has been powered by their bench. And as we know, that's harder to do in the playoffs. Like, you're just going to be seeing opposing starters a whole lot more than you do in the regular season. And so the potency of your bench being one of the biggest strengths of your team, that advantage gets negated a little bit, or maybe a lot, in the playoffs. And if you look at their starting lineup, it's been better lately, but for the season, it's kind of like close to neutral. And where they're really powering up is in those kind of mixed lineups, or, you know, with bench heavy groups on the floor. Here's what I'll say as like a potential counter to that, to play devil's advocate with myself. A huge part of their bench success has been like they've just crushed teams with Jonathan Isaac on the floor. And they're starting to ramp up his minutes now. He's playing a lot more. He's closing games for them. They'll play him at the four. A lot of time they'll play him at the five. And I think that's, you know, like as a closing look with him at the five, I don't mind it. He's been unbelievable defensively. Like, he's starting to consistently play upwards of 20 minutes a game. And if he's able to, you know, maybe scale that up a bit more to like 25 minutes, then you can maybe see some of like their bench success translating over to their starter heavy groups as well. I still don't like, I think I really like this team. I like watching them defend a lot. I think they have a very bright future. Still think they need to find, you know, their lead offensive guard of the future, but the future is very bright. I just don't think it's happening for them this year.
Okay. We want to touch on one more team before the break and one team we have not mentioned at all. What about the Pacers? Their issues are well known on the defensive side and all that, but it is interesting given that they made what I think most people would consider the most significant in-season addition. Now, you could argue that the addition of OG in New York ended up being more important, but if you're just talking about like talent add in-season, the Pacers made the biggest move of the year, and they were already a pretty solid team before that with one of the most efficient offenses of all time, yada, yada, yada. It's interesting that given all that, we have not mentioned them once in this conversation. Is that just a product of the fact that like neither, like we just don't buy them as a team that can actually be the second best in the conference, that can actually make the conference finals, that can beat one of Boston or Milwaukee in a series? Like, is that just all it is?
I mean, yeah, like I guess you'd have to give them some chance against Milwaukee in a series, given what they did to the Bucks during the regular season, beat them 4 out of 5 times. I don't think you can just throw that out the window, but yeah, I think it's, like their defense has gotten better and I think that makes them more of a threat, but I just don't, whether it's like the top end talent that I don't quite believe in compared to some of these other teams in a playoff series, given the way that Halliburton has played lately compared to where he was at the start of the year, or whether it's just as much as their defense has improved, I would still worry about how it's going to hold up to playoff scrutiny because it's just a different level of physicality, right? And as much as like Siakam's made a big difference and Turner's still a very solid rim protector and, you know, Nembhard is sticky at the point of attack, outside of Nesmith, I don't think they have like a lot of super physical defenders. And I think they're still lacking in the heft department in a way that I feel like is important in the playoffs. And Halliburton's going to get targeted. And yeah, so I don't know that I fully buy them.
And also with the Heat surging a little bit, the Pacers have technically fallen into the play-in range. They're tied in terms of like games over 500, games behind, but by winning percentage, which is how the standings are ordered, the Pacers are now 7th. And especially with the way things are right now, where that means having to start in the play-in, but also most likely having to start in the play-in against the Embiid-led 76ers.
Mm.
Even though the Pacers would be at home, I think most people would expect Philly, if Embiid's healthy, to win that game. So then it's like all of a sudden this season of promise and the big in-season trade for the Pacers ends up in a situation where it's like, well, now you better win a home game against one of Atlanta or Chicago just to make the playoffs.
Yeah, but they're tied with Miami for 6th right now. Like they're percentage points behind, but they're tied. So they could very easily get into 6th and not have to go through the play-in. And then it's like looking, I mean, it could be Orlando, could be New York, could be Cleveland in that 3 spot. I wouldn't love their chances against the Knicks, but against Orlando or Cleveland, you were asking me about like a team that could make the conference finals, and I don't think Indiana has that kind of upside. But against Orlando or Cleveland in the first round, you definitely give them better than a puncher's chance, I would say.
Agreed.
Potentially getting up to that 6th seed is going to be really important to them. As much as they might like to come out of the play-in as the 7th seed and play the Bucks in the first round, a team they, again, owned in the regular season, I think it's going to be a much easier path for them if they can get to 6. But we didn't really talk about Philly at all with Embiid back. Like, is it just too early to make any proclamations? Like, especially because Maxey didn't even play in that game. They won in a comeback, but it was against a Thunder team without Shea or Jalen Williams. I don't know what you make of that.
I mean, I don't make of anything from that game, but what I make of this team, if Joel Embiid is healthy and in the lineup and with the roster they've got after the deadline with Buddy Hield in there and Kyle Lowry, you know, looking somewhat spry. I said it earlier when we were kind of listing the teams. It's like, if you're just going by ceiling potential, like if everyone's healthy, especially now based on what's happening in New York, the Sixers would be my pick as the second best team.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I mean, look, they're 27-8 this season with Embiid in the lineup.
Right.
So
That's what I'm saying.
Hard to argue with that. And they're like plus 12 per 100 possessions with Embiid and Maxey on the floor together.
If Embiid's in the lineup, then everything else kind of holds true. And with Nick Nurse there in the playoffs, I'd probably pick this team to be in the conference finals for the first time since 2001. But as we know with the Sixers, there's a lot of time for things to still go wrong.
Well, yeah. So, and I think, again, they play that Thunder team with no J-Dub, no Shea. And it's just... On top of that being the Thunder's two best players, it's also like their only real half-court creators. Like, they just didn't have anybody who could create off the bounce in the half-court in that game. But even in that context, I think it was encouraging. As much as Embiid's conditioning just clearly wasn't all the way there, or even close to the way there, I thought actually like the biggest impact he made was at the defensive end of the floor. Like, I think he was still a massively impactful defender in that game. Again, you know, like the caveat about their opponent notwithstanding, he made some really impressive help plays at the rim, and then like comes up with that massive steal on Giddey, just defending him one-on-one on a switch down the stretch of that game, just picks his pocket, goes coast to coast, gets fouled, and that was pretty much the dagger in that game. Thought that was really encouraging. You know, his jump shot was kind of like part of the way there, not all the way there, but he got to the free throw line 12 times. I know some people were not thrilled about the way that he got there in some cases, but hit all 12 of his free throws. And I think, like, we didn't see a ton of it, like, with him and Hield. Like, there was some dribble handoff stuff. I think that's going to be a big part of their offense, like that two-man game. And none of this is going to matter nearly as much when Maxey is back. Like, Maxey didn't play in this game, so... Once Maxey's back, and if Embiid gets even up to like 80% of where he was at, that two-man game is going to be everything that their offense revolves around. But I did think it was notable, like when him and Lowry interacted in two-man game, I didn't love the way that it looked. And the reason is the Thunder were kind of doing that thing where like big Jalen Williams was guarding Embiid for most of that game. And when Lowry and Embiid would run pick and roll, Jalen Williams would give like a kind of token stunt toward the ball, but like immediately retreat to Embiid. But Lowry, who, as we've talked about, is like a very reluctant shooter and scorer at this stage of his career, was so eager to get off of the ball as early as he could that he wasn't even, whether he wasn't noticing that Jalen Williams was retreating immediately or just didn't care because he didn't want to bother trying to like drive and score, was still just trying to make the pocket pass, and it just didn't create any advantage for Embiid whatsoever. So I don't know that that two-man game is going to be a weapon for them, but I also don't know that that matters a whole ton. Like if Lowry's just like moving around off ball, spotting up around Maxey, Embiid pick and roll or dribble handoff, while also giving what he's still able to give at the defensive end or as like a connective playmaker, I think they're fine. That addition is still going to be helpful for them. So yeah, like I think, again, it's a huge if, just like it is with the Knicks and like OG's health status, but and also the Sixers are going to have a harder road than the Knicks do. Like they got to come through the play-in most likely, and then you know play, I guess, well, either Boston or Milwaukee in the first round. Like that's what they're looking at having to go through, and that's going to make it tough for them to make an actual playoff run. But yeah, if we're just looking like on paper in a vacuum, who's the second best team? I would give the nod to the fully healthy Sixers.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page there. Yeah, and like the Cavs, I mentioned them earlier. We didn't really get into it. But again, you know, after that really inspiring run where they looked like they would be the second best team in the East, they've gone 11-15. They've been very pedestrian. I mentioned Donovan Mitchell kind of calling the team out, saying it's effing April.
There are two different versions of this team. Like there's who they are when Donovan Mitchell is fully healthy and operating at the peak of his powers. Yeah. And then there's who they are when, you know, he is either out of the lineup or operating in a diminished capacity, as it feels like he clearly is right now coming back from that knee injury. So that's really all it is for them. Like if they can find a way to get him up to 100% in the playoffs, then I think they can be a real threat. And if not, then they can't. I think it's really that simple. As much growth as there has been from Jared Allen this season, as good as they can be defensively, as much as I think their optionality on the wing is like so far above where it was last year that that could really help them in a playoff setting, improve on last year's result. if Mitchell isn't the Mitchell that he was when this team was rolling, I don't think any of that really matters. So like for the season, they're 34-17 when he plays and 12-13 when he doesn't. +7 net rating with him on the court, -1.3 with him on the bench. Like it all comes down to him. Yeah. So that's the big thing. And then, you know, the other piece of news with them was like Dan Gilbert coming out and saying that he believes that Mitchell's going to sign an extension this offseason, which, you know, Dan Gilbert's going to say some things. I don't know how much stock we should put in that, but it seemed notable.
I mean, I don't know if they really seem notable. Like,
I think it might depend on how they actually do in the playoffs. Like, right, if they get bounced in 5 games in the first round again, then I don't think Mitchell's signing that extension.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. He said that, I think, 48 hours later, Mitchell comes out kind of complaining about how the team has played recently. They got bounced in the first round last year after a good year. Like, I'm not saying it. He's definitely not signing the extension. I'm just saying that Dan Gilbert saying he thinks it's going to happen is not notable to me 3 weeks before the playoffs start.
Fair.
Real quick, because I did forget to mention it when we were talking about the Bucks road woes and you know, Doc's comments. Of the top 8 teams in the league right now by record, the Bucks are the only one with a losing record on the road. Whether that matters or not, guess we'll see. I think we've given the East enough time and attention here. I want to take the break, come back, and talk about an absolute bloodbath of a West playoff race.
Let's do it.
What's up, Pound the Rock listeners? Just a friendly reminder to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also check out the Scores Fantasy Football Podcast with Justin Boone. And in case you haven't already, download the Score app, available on iPhone and Android. That's where you can find all of our feature content, as well as live scores, updates, and breaking news. And don't forget to check out the Score's YouTube page for an informative yet lighthearted dive into the sports world's trending topics. Now back to the show. All right, well, Fawn, I think out West, all of these teams and all of these, honestly, contenders have less questions to answer and address than the East teams, but the waters are still murky just because of how many good contending level teams there are out West. And listen, we can exclude the top three because we've talked about them throughout the year. Your top three, Joe Wolfond's top three in the West, coming to fruition just as he envisioned it. Those Northwest teams, the Nuggets, the Wolves, and the Thunder there. I think we can ignore them for today because those are going to be the top three teams in the West. And I think we can talk more about the playoff race out West, which is, especially with the Clippers coming back down to earth, essentially like from 4 to 11, not that those teams can finish anywhere from 4 to 11, but from 4 to 11, there are a lot of things to still be determined.
Before we get there, though, can we at least just give like a 2-minute hat tip to what the Wolves have done without Karl Anthony Towns? Like the fact that they are still clinging to that number one seed in the Western Conference.
Dude, what did we talk
Nas,
about?
Nas fucking Reed. I'm not going to say that like I called it, but I did say when we were like on the episode when we were talking about Towns' injury, I was like, I don't think there's actually that much of a difference, at least not as much as people might expect, in terms of offensive skill sets from Towns to Naz Reid. And like, man, he has slid into, they finally moved him into the starting lineup. Like the first few games after the injury, he was coming off the bench. Now he's starting, and God, has he been good.
Yeah, and like we talked about on that episode as well, neither one of us thought there would be much slippage here because the defensive infrastructure and defensive talent was still there, obviously. And with the way Anthony Edwards is playing and the level he's gotten to as a star in this league, that kind of offensive star and the defensive infrastructure around him, like a team with that kind of combination isn't going to fall off a cliff because they lost Karl Anthony Towns. No disrespect to Karl Anthony Towns. And that's kind of what you've seen. Like the defense is still held up as we expected it would. Anthony Edwards was outrageous those first, like that first week or two. He's still been great overall, but like that first week without Kat was unbelievable. So fun to watch. And yeah, like you have that mix, still have depth. They're fine. Don't get me wrong. They want Kat back. And I think their overall ceiling, if this team is going to potentially win a championship, which I think they are built to do, they need Kat back, but don't really think there was any reason to believe they were going to fall off a cliff in the regular season, nor have they.
Yeah, and I also want to say, like, Kyle Anderson was having a really tough season until the past couple of weeks, frankly. And his playmaking has just been such an important wheel greaser for that offense in the absence of Towns. Obviously, the spacing is going to be what it is, but there are a lot of different things they can do with him to kind of mitigate that. You know, like they'll run these like double drag screens, or like they'll actually run him off of like ghost flare action, which is like a lot of times something you'll do for a movement shooter, which Kyle Anderson obviously is not. But it's a multi-screener action where Gobert's setting the first screen, or he's setting the flare screen, and then he's diving, and then they'll hit Kyle Anderson on the wing with the pass, and he'll be the one hitting Gobert on the roll. And I think that the pass that he is the best at making is that pass over the top. Like, he does such a good job finding Gobert in those situations, whether it's in those kind of like Mo Dekeel, I know, calls it a seven pass, like that, because it makes a seven, it goes to the wing, and then it hits the roll man. Whether it's that pass or just when Gobert, like whether he's sealing a switch or he's like just running down the floor, like getting an early seal in transition, like Kyle Anderson is the guy who's going to throw the ball over the top and find Gobert when he has those mismatches. His playmaking, his defense, that's been huge for them as well. And it's like, you can see even when Ant has a real down game offensively, as he did against the Rockets in their last win, they have these other guys who can pick him up, like Naz Reid, like Mike Conley, who's been tremendous since Cat went down. And it's just like always the guy who steadies the ship when it's rocking. Kyle Anderson, like Jordan McLaughlin, was unbelievable in that game as well. And Ant himself has gotten to the point with like his playmaking and his defense where even if he can't buy a bucket, he's still contributing in meaningful ways. Like this, I was already, you know, like pretty high on this team, obviously, and what they could potentially do in the playoffs. But I would say this stretch has just given me a lot more confidence in how dangerous this can be as a playoff team. And I agree with you. I think they do need Cat back if they're going to make like a serious run. But I'm at the point where I fully see them winning a first round series even without him.
Yeah. All right, moving down to like the teams that are more in the race, because again, those three teams at the top are in a race for the one seed, but they are so firmly entrenched in that top three that it's like two separate conferences in a way. It's two separate tiers. And the second tier begins with the Los Angeles Clippers. That 31-8 tear that propelled them all the way to first place feels like a long time ago. They have been very mid since, over the last basically couple months. They're 13-13. Since February 7th, with the number 12 offense and the number 28 defense over that 26-game span going back just about 2 months. So they had like a half-season sample where they looked like the juggernaut they should be when healthy. And for the rest of the season, they like not just uninspiring and still good, like straight-up mediocre for the rest of the time. So how much do you trust this team? And unlike previous years, I'm saying put aside the like, you know, prior durability concerns and all that. I'm saying even when healthy, this team right now, what you've seen from them over the course of the whole season, how much do you trust them?
Well, yeah, because what I was going to say is like, how much did we really trust them to begin with? Right. Even when, you know, they were on that tear, it's like, this is a team that engenders trust issues, let's be honest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think those trust issues still very much exist. And it's not, like, I guess I would point to James Harden and his fall off as like the single most concerning thing. I think there's been a drop off with Kawhi as well, but he's the one guy where I'm like, you know, the trust issues with him solely stem from his health and whether he's actually going to be able to make it through a playoff run or even a playoff series unscathed. But I do think he's started to slow down. I think I talked on a previous episode about how, you know, with the amount he's played this year compared to previous seasons, maybe that is catching up to him. But I think, look, I had all these concerns about the Clippers last year. They were mid all year. Kawhi, he did definitely like turn it on late season, but you didn't know how he was going to react in a playoff setting, especially because Paul George wasn't going to play. And then in that Sun series before he got hurt, he was by far the best player on the floor in those first two games. So I just, until I am given a reason to believe otherwise, I'm going to have to assume that if he's healthy, he's still the guy who's probably going to be the best player on the floor in a playoff series against anyone except Denver. With Harden, obviously the playoff baggage is already there. And then you had he had this brilliant stretch of basketball powering them in large part to that 27-5 run that they had. I was on here touting not only his offensive contributions, but his defense. The way that he was working as a low man, like getting a ton of deflections, playing super active, heady defense, and like all of that has fallen by the wayside. Like he, if there's a culprit, it's not just him. Like, you know, Norm Powell, I think, is like one of the poorer defenders in the league. As much as he's important to what they do offensively, he's not a good defender. Zubac has had some pullback defensively. Kawhi hasn't been quite at the level he was at defensively early in the season. But like, I think the biggest culprit in that 28th ranked defense has been Harden. And he is just nowhere near where he was at defensively when he first got to the Clippers. So yeah, I don't know. And like, it's funny because when we talked about them last, we were talking about teams that we had previously considered confusing, and you cited the Clippers, and I mostly agreed with you that like they weren't confusing anymore. We felt like we had a good handle on what they were, and in our minds what they were was like a close to an inner circle contender basically. But at that time they were on, I think, like a 3-7 stretch that we sort of hand waved away, but they had just had that loss to the Lakers where all of their old bad habits resurfaced. The, you know, the soft switching on defense that got roasted, but then also like on offense, how their pace and purpose had totally dried up and it had devolved into these slow moving, slow developing, like ISO heavy possessions that were eating up a ton of clock to not even generate good looks. And I feel like the most worrying thing is that that trend has kind of carried through over the few weeks since.
Listen, Ty Lue's a pretty straight shooter. When Ty Lue comes out and says this team doesn't have an identity and they're soft, like, I know coaches say stuff all the time, they're trying to motivate their guys, but there are some times when it's like, oh, you know, I don't like where this is going. And Ty Lue feeling the need to say that about a team like this veteran laden that for various reasons should goddamn know better by now, like, is very concerning and just makes you wonder, like, for whatever reason, like maybe this collection of talent, like they just don't have it, you know? And I think we're like past the point where it's like, yeah, that just might be the case. Also, with respect, just because you mentioned Norm Powell's defense, I've said this before, I'll say it again. Norm Powell getting into a defensive crouch and a defensive stance, to me, has always been the defensive equivalent of Dion Waiters yelling "and one" while driving to the basket and not drawing the foul, and also not finishing the bucket.
Yeah, and but I mean, they really need him offensively is the thing, yes, right?
He's no, one of the few, no argument there.
He's one of the few players on that team that gives them like real downhill pressure, right? Like he will come off of a curl and explode to the rim. He will tear through a defense in transition and get all the way to the rim. And he is straight up, he's one of the best shooters in the NBA and has been for the last 5 years, right? Like, I think that's maybe flown under the radar a little bit, but he is like consistently in like the mid 40s and is at 44% now from 3-point range this season. So they need him offensively. But yeah, like the reason that I hear him brought up in a lot of Sixth Man of the Year conversations, and I know defense has never been a big factor in Sixth Man of the Year voting. Like Lou Williams won it how many times? Jamal Crawford's won it how many times? But that's the reason that I can't quite get there with him in those conversations. And it's not like, I don't know if Malik Monk is like much better than Norm Powell defensively, or like Naz Reid is much better than Norm Powell defensively, but they're definitely better. So that's why I would favor those guys in that particular conversation. But yeah, I think, you know, just back to the Clippers in general, I, you know, a lot of people talked about how they kind of lost their identity after Russ got injured and were like, you know, they need to get Russ back so they can recapture that kind of like pace and intensity that they were playing with before. And it's not even so much that I disagreed with that as much as I was like, if what you're relying on to get your season back on the rails is late career Russell Westbrook, then you're not in the best spot. So that's kind of how I feel about that.
Yeah. It's almost like, as Ty Lue said, they're a soft team that doesn't really have an identity.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, the thing is, their identity can just be like Kawhi, like go and be the best player on the floor and win us this game while Paul George hits like seven threes, and that can still work. But, you know, obviously, even in that case, they're going to have to be better than 28th defensively to do anything meaningful. Yeah. So
they've been atrocious on that end. Like I said, it's, you know, we're not talking about a 10-game blip here. We're talking about like a 2-month, 26-game sample. All right, we've talked about the Mavs recently when we just talked about like the new faces and new places after the deadline. Not sure how much you want to get into them again, but they're playing like 650 ball since the break with an improved defense. Luka and Kyrie especially has been, you know, mostly available. Both of them have been really prolific. Is there anything we haven't mentioned with the Mavs a couple weeks ago that you want to discuss right now, or should we leave it there?
I mean, I think we can more or less leave it there. I do think they've impressed me. I think that they've been pretty solid defensively, which is all they need to be, I think, to, you know, potentially win a series or two. And the interplay between Kyrie and Luka has been great. And like I say all the time, you don't have to necessarily interact in two-man action to be mutually complementary and amplify each other. And I, you know, the Mavs don't run a ton of Luka, Kyrie, two-man game, but they still, like, even if it's just as simple as Luka bending the defense, Kyrie is one pass away, and he's, like, attacking the diagonal gap to beat the nail help, like, just capitalizing on the gravity that Luka creates, the advantages that he creates, that's hugely important on its own, and I think that's happening a lot. And, you know, they'll also interact in like three-man action, right? Like where it's like multi-screeners for Luka and Kyrie, whether he's the first screener or the second screener, he's the one popping open. And that's either like forcing a defense to switch, or eventually two are going with Luka and Kyrie's finding himself open. Like they're, I've liked the interplay between the two of them, and I do think they're amplifying each other, even if it's not like directly in two-man action. So that looks good. And then, you know, defensively, their interior defense has just improved immeasurably since their deadline additions. I've given PJ Washington his flowers for how much better he's been defensively than he had been previously, and than I expected him to be, despite all the offensive frustration with him. And I think that they're just looking like a much more balanced team. The question, apart from just like the defensive question, with Dallas is always like, okay, well, can a team with that big a drop off between their top two to their next best player, you know, is that team championship caliber? And I think that's, it's always like a little bit of a simplistic question when you frame things that way. Like the Lakers won a championship with KCP as their third best player.
Right. Who are the top two is the question, right?
Like, who are the top two? And like, you know, Luka and Kyrie aren't quite on the level of LeBron and AD in 2020, but it's pretty damn good top two. And then it's also about, like, you can do the sort of third best player by committee thing if you have enough quality role players who can all excel in those roles. And I feel like that's sort of what Dallas has with, like, you know, they have something of a third best player by committee between, you know, Gafford, Lively, Tim Hardaway Jr., Dante Exum, DJJ, who am I forgetting? Josh Green, Kleba, like all these
Washington
guys. PJ Washington, right? Like who just kind of like fill in gaps in different ways, and they can sort of cover all their bases by committee. Now, I don't think that the Mavs have championship upside.
No.
I'm just not there with them. I still don't think their defense can be good enough. But I can totally see them winning a round or even two. Like, I think they, with the way that Luka is playing right now and the way that Kyrie is playing off of him, I do think they are that dangerous. I don't know that I would consider it likely that they're in the conference finals, but I think no matter who they play in the first round, to me, it's probably going to be something like a coin flip. And from there, yeah, I feel like they, I guess it just depends on matchups and who they wind up playing. You know, like if they can play anyone but Denver in rounds one, and if there is a round two, then in round two, then yeah, I will give them a pretty decent chance of being a conference finalist with the way they're playing right now.
I think we can say that about a lot of the teams that we're gonna talk about in this conversation, though, where it's like Yeah, as long as they if they avoid Denver, I think they could maybe get the conference finals.
But I think that I kind of think Dallas is like at the top of that pile.
Interesting.
Like not I'm talking about like outside of the top three that we're not going
to
talk about.
Like from the 4 to 11, like you're saying.
I think Dallas is at the top of that pile. I would, you know, so okay. I think I would pick Minnesota to beat them in a series.
Yep.
I would definitely pick Denver to beat them in a series. Anyone other than that, and I think it's like at worst a 50-50 shot. Even against OKC, I think it's like 50-50 shot. That's how I feel.
All right.
What do you think?
I don't think it'd be a 50-50 shot. I think I'd give them a decent chance of beating any of those teams, including OKC, but I would still lean OKC.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay, that's fine. But like, if you're leaning OKC by the slimmest of margins, then that's not far off from like the scenario that I'm presenting either.
But it's not 50-50. I wouldn't give the Mavs an equal chance to win the series as I do the Thunder or...
Well, ultimately, if it came to that, I would still have to make a pick. I wouldn't, like, you know, I wouldn't be like, well, one of these teams is going to win. I don't know who it is.
I could see you just saying it's 50-50 and leaving it at that.
If I'm saying it's 50-50 and like OKC has home court advantage, then that would probably tilt it to OKC for me. I'm just saying like
50-50 in a neutral setting in the bubble.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that's just, I'm just saying that as a way to like frame where I have landed on the quality of their team. And I mean, you just can't say enough about the way that Luka's playing right now. It's just the control and the mastery that he seems to have over every game. And the, just like the way that he has every defense on puppet strings is, you know, maybe it's not quite Jokic level. I don't think it is, because Jokic can create better shots for himself than Luka can. Like, Luka is still relying pretty heavily on a lot of those step back threes going in.
Yeah.
But right now, a lot of them are going in. So it's pretty remarkable what he's doing at the offensive end.
Yeah, I said it a few weeks ago. Luka Doncic becoming a 37-38% high volume 3-point shooter this year is literally unfair given the rest of his skill set.
Yeah. And also, like, I'm not breaking news here about him being an exceptional passer, but I think somehow he's actually gotten a little bit better at passing this year. Like, I would point to, I don't have the examples off the top of my head, unfortunately, but like some of the passes that he makes that don't even lead directly to assists. There was just one the other night where he was getting trapped basically at half court, like to the point that he was at risk of like falling back over the half court line and committing an over and back violation. And he whipped a high velocity cross court pass out of that trap that landed in the weak side corner. And I think it was Exum who caught it, was able to attack a closeout. And then that led to a PJ Washington three on the other side. But like, I'm just like gobsmacked by so many of the passes he makes. Like, I think I would call him probably the second best passer in the NBA right now.
After Jokic.
I think to me, there's like a clear top five right now, like Jokic, Luka,
LeBron,
Trey, Haliburton would be my top five. And I think I'm giving Luka number two.
That's right fair. Now. Look, just like historically speaking, players playing at this level, of which, by the way, there have not been many in basketball history, but players playing at this level or near it have a chance in the playoffs. Teams that have a player that good have a chance in the playoffs. With a running mate as good as Kyrie Irving, they have a chance in the playoffs. Like, I totally get your point with respect to like them having more than just a puncher's chance in pretty much any matchup except for one against the Nuggets. It's just that even though it's improved, the defense and that third player, whether people think it matters or not, are the two things where I'm just like, I look at this team and I'm like, I can't see that deep playoff run, even as great as Luka and to a lesser extent Kyrie is. Now, a team that has that third player and yet has still been pretty confounding all season, the Phoenix Suns. We talked a couple weeks ago when they were still very firmly in the play-in range. I think at the time they were eighth. And they had this just absolute murderer's row of a finishing schedule coming up. The next day, it ended up being tweeted out by ESPN Stats and Information that Phoenix's final 10 games in terms of strength of schedule was the toughest concluding 10-game stretch of a season any team has had since the 2015-16 Grizzlies. And yet, they have actually moved up as they've started to embark on that 10-game stretch. They leapfrogged New Orleans last night. They are up to sixth in the West now, temporarily at least, out of play-in range. The big three, Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Bradley Beal, have now played 12 straight games together. Beal has really taken a back seat lately, but it's worked. They're 8-4 in those 12 games with wins over Cleveland, a super impressive win in Denver, pretty impressive win in New Orleans the other night, no Ingram, but still a big win. And at the same time, they've also lost to the Wemby-less Spurs and got crushed by the Shea-less Thunder during that time. So they've been better. They've been healthier. Still think they leave a lot to be desired in terms of consistency, where you just can't trust which version of the Suns will show up night to night. And then the final point, and I guess question I have for you, is how much stock do you put in the fourth quarter stuff, and how much does it matter? Like, they are, by all accounts, the worst fourth quarter team in the NBA this year, by point differential, by points scored, by, like, all of that. How much do you think it matters? Like, is it just, is it a weirdly arbitrary thing to take one quarter out of the four for a regular season and be like, well, this is the fourth quarter and it's the one that matters most, and they're the worst team at it, and therefore they are not a contender? Or do you think it matters? Do you think the fact that they not just tread water, but, like, for the most part, fail as often as they do in fourth quarters is an indictment of this team and a bad sign of things to come?
Well, it's not good.
But, like, do you,
I don't think that I have a great explanation for it. And so, because I don't have a great explanation for it, I don't know that I can put a ton of stock in it. I think, like, people are going to say that the fourth quarter is the most important quarter, and that's when you will reveal who you truly are. And I don't know that I fully agree with that. Like,
it's a 48-minute game.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a 48-minute game. The other quarters are, like, in the grand scheme of things, equally important. If you're talking about crunch time, that's when it's like, if you want to tell me that's what reveals who a team truly is, because in crunch time, every team is putting its best lineup on the floor, valuing every possession in a way that it might not be the rest of the game, that's when I can kind of, like, yeah, I can get behind that and understand why crunch time would maybe be a good revealer of how, like, I've talked about that with the Nuggets before. That's when the Nuggets get serious, and I don't believe, in the way that it maybe sometimes is, you know, for certain teams, a fluke when you just win a ton of close games, I don't really feel that way about the Nuggets, because they feel like the type of team that when it's time to get serious, they can get more serious than anybody else. In crunch time, the Suns haven't been, like, awful. They're 18-20 in games that are within 5 points in the last 5 minutes with, you know, a minus 4.8 net rating. So that's not good, but it's not, like, appallingly, it's not the worst in the league as they are in the fourth quarters in general. And if you look at the fourth quarters as a whole, like, most teams start the fourth quarter with their best players on the bench. For 3, 4, sometimes 5 minutes. So a lot of times that's actually more about, like, what your transitional lineups do than what your starting groups do. But yeah, I just don't know what to attribute it to, because it's not like, you know, I've talked about this with the Celtics too. Like, yeah, their offense can, like, bog down into isolation play and be a little bit too slow and unimaginative in those situations. But A, that's not different from pretty much any other team in the league, outside of maybe, like, Denver, Golden State. And B, it's not that different from how they play the rest of the time.
Yeah.
So I don't know really what to attribute that to. But generally speaking, okay, so you mentioned all, like, the kind of seesaw that it has been for them recently, right? Like, they lose that game to the Spurs without Wemby, one of the worst losses for any team this season, given the stakes involved in Phoenix trying to get out of the play-in. Their next game, they beat the Nuggets with one of their best defensive showings of the season. And it was, like, you know, no Jamal Murray for Denver, but also no Nurkic for Phoenix. I'm not saying that's an even trade-off, but, like, it meant that the Suns had to guard Jokic with Drew Eubanks and, like, Thad Young that entire game. Okay, they win that one. Their next game, they get taken to the fucking woodshed by the Thunder without SGA. And then they turn around from that and they roast the Pelicans and Cavs in back-to-back games. I don't know what to do with that. And it makes me wonder, because I do feel like I've been having these kind of conflicted feelings about more teams than usual at this stage of a season, is it the fact that maybe we're in an era where a lot is determined by jump shooting variance, that for a jump shooting team like Phoenix, it's just inevitable that we're going to see those kinds of swings?
I think that's a very good observation and a very fair point. I think it's probably the case. And it, again, we talked about that even with respect to like the parity in the modern NBA and the upset potential being greater on any given night because of the variance that comes with the proliferation of three-pointers and jumpers in general. I think that's all valid, and especially with respect to this Suns team. I also think that that's part of the reason why they're so untrustworthy in the playoffs. Not because of the old, like, oh, jump shooting teams can't win champions. No, like, we know that's BS. But more so just because of how much variance their offensive profile brings with it. Because as I've said before, even when we talked about them last year, even after they got the KD, it's not just about them being jumper happy. Like, the Warriors, when they won titles, both in the KD era and the era when they won it in 2015, when they won it in 2022, or whenever the last one was, got to the rim still way more than this Suns team does, right? And that's the thing where the Suns, like, it's they're jumper happy and they don't get to the rim. Like,
they are shooting more threes than they did last year. So that's
that helps the math a little bit compared to, because last year they were super jumper happy. They were the worst in terms of getting to the rim. And they didn't shoot as many threes as you'd expect from a team with that much shooting potential. So the math,
they are still number one in long mid-range frequency, right, to be fair. But
yeah, and that's what I'm saying. The math is a little better this year, but it's still not great.
Yeah.
And
but, you know, they also get to the free throw line a ton, which, you know, maybe going into the playoffs is not the thing that you want to be relying on math-wise. But especially because, you know, I think as we talk about their kind of like rim deficiencies, you know, they draw a lot of their shooting fouls on jump shots, and those feel like the kinds of fouls that won't get called as often in the playoffs.
Yeah, so I think all of which is to say, I think you are bang on in that their variance in results this season and their kind of seesaw season can be tied to the variance that comes with being a jumper-happy team, and I also think that that's a big part of the reason why they are so untrustworthy come April, May, and you know, June, if they get there, which I don't think they will.
Yeah. And it's just like taking a holistic view coming into the year. If you'd have told me that with like 8 games left in the season or 6 games left in the season, that they would be 13th in defensive efficiency, I would have been like, man, this is a serious contender, because I expected them to have a top five offense. And it hasn't been that way. They've been like near the, like, they've been flirting with top 10 pretty much all year. I think they're 9th right now, which is good, but if that is supposed to be what you hang your hat on as a team, I don't think that's good enough. And they have these games where KD and or Booker can go absolutely nuclear. That game against the Pelicans, Booker, for the third time in a row, could not be stopped. 3 straight games against New Orleans where he's dropped 50 or more. I don't know what New Orleans did to Devin Booker, but, you know, he has some kind of vendetta seemingly against that team. They have those kinds of games where one or both of those guys can absolutely go off, and there's just nothing you can do as a defense but throw your hands up. But, you know, that's going to lead to some ups and downs, I guess. And that's why I think they're just so hard to peg, because they could go on a heater and swing a big upset in the playoffs, absolutely. But I think if we're talking about making a deep run, beyond their capability to swing an upset, maybe two, I just don't think that they can do that 3 or 4 times in a row.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
You mentioned those Pelicans that Devin Booker has some sort of vendetta against. The Pelicans, for me, I'm going to shout out great friend of the show, Alex Wong here, who the first time I'd ever heard someone use this was Alex Wong talking about the 2023 Toronto Blue Jays last year. And he said they were like the reverse godfather for him. Every time he thought he was in, they pulled him back out. And that's the New Orleans Pelicans for me. Every time I think, oh, I'm finally in on this team, they pull me back out. They are my reverse godfather. every time I start to believe they go through this puzzling stretch that confirms their fraudulence to me. Now, again, this week, I actually scripted and shot an unfiltered for this week's episode of our YouTube series, where I talk about how like an understated but healthy version of Zion this year has been what the Pelicans needed, been what a good Pelicans team has needed, and that they now had the statistical profile of a contender. Like, we're talking about a team that's top five in point differential on the season. We are talking about a team that since that humiliating in-season tournament loss to the Lakers, which is a stretch now of almost 4 months, have been top five on both ends of the court, and the only other team that has been that for that long is Boston. And then they get run off their home floor by Phoenix and Orlando this week. And yes, Brandon Ingram out for both of those games, but still, you have to have
and
a better
Zion sat out, I think, the whole fourth quarter in the game.
Yes, with some sort of finger injury. But again, yeah, they lost to two good teams and no Ingram, but I don't know. The way they lost is concerning and goes back to that reverse Godfather thing with me where I just can't, for whatever reason, anytime it seems like they've gotten over a hump, okay, they're just a good team that I believe in now, they remind me why I shouldn't. But overall, like, you look at like the elite defense, multiple shot creators and tough shot makers in Ingram and CJ, Zion and JV just battering Rams inside with shooters around them, even if, you know, perhaps they still don't shoot enough. They've got the potential offensively of like a three-level scoring team that can survive the muddy waters of the playoffs. They're having a good year overall, and yet here we are still in this place where I'm like, do I actually believe in this team as a contender? And this week has reminded me that I shouldn't. Am I putting too much stock in, you know, just a bad week that all teams have? Or do you kind of see where I'm coming from with New Orleans?
I mean, I think it goes back to a lot of what we talked about on that like most confusing teams episode, where all their sort of overlying numbers tell you this is a contender. They've been top 10 on both sides of the ball pretty much all year. But I just look at, first of all, Herb Jones, I think, deserves like some legitimate defensive player of the year consideration. I don't think he'll win. If I were to have a vote, I don't think he would be at the top of my ballot, but I think he would be on my ballot. You know, behind Gobert and maybe behind Anthony Davis. But like, that's it in terms of defensive impact players have made this season. He is absolutely incredible, puts out so many fires. And I just like, yeah, I have faith in him to be able to some degree to hold that defense together. But as I've said for pretty much all year, I don't think that their defense is actually quite this good. And I think that there are some things that could get exposed in a playoff setting. I will say that some of that has been mitigated recently by the way that Zion has defended. The stuff that I talked about in terms of like, they can't find a ball screen coverage for him that works. His hedges have been 100 times better these last few weeks than they were early in the year. And they're switching him, I think, more than they were at the beginning of the year. And he's been better than I would have expected in those situations as well. They're also putting him on like top scoring wings, putting him on Kawhi Leonard, putting him on Giannis Antetokounmpo. Like, he has the size to do it. He's showing that maybe he has like the lateral agility to be able to do that as well. That's changed my mind about that a little bit. But they still have pressure points that can be hit that Herb Jones can't account for all by himself. And so I just don't think going into the playoffs that I actually buy them as a top five defense. And then, you know, like whether, what does their offense look like in the playoffs? Zion has been a lot better on that end recently as well. And I think, you know, I've talked before how I just don't think him and Ingram are like perfectly mutually complementary, but I do think we've seen in the absence of Ingram, how they miss having that ball handling presence down the stretch of games. They're another team that's just been terrible in crunch time pretty much all year.
Yeah.
Even when Ingram was there. So I don't know what to make of that. Like, they just can't quite synergize those two, even when they're both healthy. So what they've done, you know, with Ingram out, and I'm curious to see if they can combine these two elements, is like the Zion and Trey Murphy actions are kind of like their staple food right now. And those have been really effective for them. You know, Trey Murphy setting that low, flat ball screen for Zion and then popping out of it. Or I mentioned like the ghost flare action earlier, like that's something they run for Trey Murphy a ton. Coming up, setting the ghost screen, and then they have their big man, JV or Larry Nance, setting the flare for Trey Murphy to come off of. They get him a ton of not just like good 3-point looks on those plays, but like Trey Murphy as a driver has come a long, long way this season. And so I don't like, as I said, when Ingram went down, like I don't think they have actually felt his absence to the extent that you might expect for a player of his magnitude. But I do think they still need him back if they're going to win a playoff series, most likely. I don't know. I guess I just come down on feeling like their defense isn't quite as good as this. And so if their offense can't level up, if they can't be better than they've been with all of Ingram, Zion, and CJ on the floor together when they're supposed to be making their bones, then yeah, it's going to be hard for them to win a series. Like we talked about the trust factor with the Clippers, right? But if that's a first round matchup, and right now it wouldn't be, Dallas has actually supplanted New Orleans as number five. But if that were the first round matchup, I think the trust scale would still tilt toward the Clippers.
I agree.
Because I'm like, okay, like I believe that the Pelicans can win this series, but you got to show me that Zion can actually survive defensively in a playoff setting and that, you know, they're going to have an answer for a Clippers team that just has more pure shot making than they do and more experience. And like, even for a Clippers team that I don't trust all that much, I would still be inclined to trust them more than I trust the Pelicans.
With one of the most trustworthy players in the playoffs when healthy too.
And the Pelicans also just, I know this is not going to be anything that Pelicans fans haven't heard before. I feel like it's been a big talking point for them, but Willie Green every season kind of has this player I feel like that he fetishizes and overplays. And I think this season that's been Larry Nance. And specifically, he is like always closing games with like their starters and Nance in JV's place. And I personally just much prefer when they lean into their identity as like a huge bully ball kind of team. And those lineups with Nance at center, as much as they are theoretically, you know, quote unquote switchable and should be more versatile defensively, have not been good. And he is not giving them nearly enough on offense to justify whatever value they think they're getting defensively, which I don't even think is like that big a bump. Like, yes, they're more switchable, but their rim protection and their rebounding still takes a hit when he's out there playing the five. So I, you know, that gives me some concern too, that like that appears to be like their option for like, if they don't like a matchup for JV, which they don't seem to like any matchup for JV these days, like that's what they go to. It just doesn't breed a lot of confidence either.
The Kings currently reside in eighth.
I mean, Kevin Huerter and Malik Monk are pretty much done for the season. So
yeah, losing Malik Monk, I think, hurt. Listen, losing Kevin Huerter hurts too, but Keon Ellis has been great in their starting lineup. And so agreed, with all due respect to Kevin Huerter, like I don't think that would have sunk them, or far from it. Malik Monk most likely being done should sink them.
Yeah, and even with Huerter, he's taken a big step back from where he was at last year, but he's still such a big part of their offensive identity. You know, like running the DHO game with Sabonis, just providing that threat level as a shooter. Like again, yes, I agree. Keon Ellis has been great, and their defense has been much better this year, and especially with him on the floor. Davion Mitchell now is getting more run, so like it's kind of changing the identity of this team from one that is like very, very offense focused to one that's actually like pretty defense oriented now. And I think that's an interesting shift. I don't know entirely what it means for their playoff prospects, but you know, like, look, if Sabonis can be the Sabonis of the regular season rather than the Sabonis that he was in the playoffs last year, then that changes the equation for them.
Yeah.
You know, even more than just like not like being without Malik Monk, Kevin Huerter, that hurts a ton, but like Sabonis just being this version of Sabonis would be enough to me to maybe offset that. But those are just really, really tough losses for a team that I already was like not fully believing in as a playoff team.
I hear you. All right, the Lakers. Not quite the same storyline as last year because they didn't remake the team the way they did at the trade deadline a year ago. I said at the time of the deadline this year, like, oh, there's no saving this team this time around anyway. And yet, kind of deja vu from last year in the sense of like spring comes and here come the Lakers. They've won 8 of 9. They went from looking pretty set in that 9 seed to now being 2 back of 5th. They're 20-8 since February 1st with wins over the Celtics, Knicks, Pelicans, Clippers, Thunder, Bucks twice, including both without LeBron, win over the Timberwolves during that time. Like, they've been really good for a couple months now. LeBron and AD have been predictably awesome all year, both still all NBA level, with AD, as we both said, playing the best ball of his career. But now Reeves has looked more like the guy we expected to see continuing his breakout this year. He's looked more like that guy recently. D'Angelo Russell, like, during this 20-8 stretch, has averaged 20 points on 46% shooting from two, 43% from deep, 84% from the free throw line. Has averaged 6.7 assists during that time and an assist to turnover ratio of greater than 3-1, playing just under 36 minutes per game and playing 26 of those 28 games. They have settled on that starting lineup that I know we talked about and you mentioned it, the one that ended last year, that it didn't seem like they were going to enough this year with LeBron, AD, Reeves, Russell, and Rui Hachimura. They seem to have found their identity. LeBron is nursing, I think, is it an ankle injury or what it is, that he's been kind of in and out of the lineup, but when he's been in the lineup, it's obviously been great. Where are we on this team? Because, like, all of a sudden, you look at the last 2+ months sample, and it's like, is the same thing happening as last year? Like, is this team all of a sudden about to make a run? Do you have nearly the same faith you had in that post-deadline version of the team last year?
I think that this is pretty much a team of exactly equivalent quality to the one that we saw at the end of last year. And so I have less faith in them making a run because this Western Conference is just way, way better than last year's West was. So, you know, again, like we've said with all of these teams, of course they have a puncher's chance to, you know, win a series if they can avoid Denver. But, you know, as far as making a run to the conference finals, I would consider that much, much less likely than it was last year, just for those reasons. But, you know, I do think it's worth pointing out, we had all these conversations about the state of their offense early in the year, and they have completely turned that around. Like, fifth in the league in offensive efficiency since the All-Star break. They were 18th before that. At the same time, they've gone from 15th to 22nd in defensive efficiency. And where does that net them out, Cash? 15th in offense, 15th in defense. Just exactly average.
Mid-city.
And they're 19th in net rating, by the way. So I think they're better than that, than, you know, than those kind of like statistical indicators would suggest. But it's like the extreme version of what we were talking about with Milwaukee, like the even Steven thing. One side comes up, the other side comes down. And they just sort of net out to being this good but not great team that on the right day can approach greatness, can put a serious scare into one of these top teams in the West, maybe even beat them. But as far as like making a deep run, I'm still not totally convinced. But I do think it's notable that they have completely turned things around on offense. And yes, the way that Reeves has played lately, the way that Russell has played, Anthony Davis has been tremendous. Yeah. Like that's all very encouraging. And the fact that they have finally, you know, they landed on that starting lineup that they maybe should have landed on a lot earlier, and it's performing very well. I think Rui in his role has been really good. That's all good, solid, encouraging stuff. But then it's like they're always having to make these lineup decisions and roster decisions based on which side of the ball they want to prioritize. And I think it's kind of hard for them to find that balance. Even having to, like, I don't know if you want to call LeBron like a two-way player at this point. He can still turn it up on defense to the point that I would call him that. And then Anthony Davis, who's been, like I said, probably the second best defender in basketball this season. Even having those two guys at the center of everything, you're still finding it hard to like juggle things in such a way that you're not getting hurt at one end of the floor or the other. So,
yeah. And to your point about like the tougher West this year too, like they won 8 of 9, they're on a 20-8 run and they've climbed all the way to ninth. Like they basically haven't moved during that time because the West is so good. So yeah, it's going to be tough for them to enjoy the kind of postseason success they did last year, but it's at least notable that they are hitting this stride at this time of year, given who their best two players are.
Yeah, but let's just say, so like if the season ended today, they'd be in ninth. They would have to win a home game against the Warriors to advance past play-in stage one. Then they would play the loser of New Orleans Sacramento on the road. And by the way, they got swept by the Kings this season.
Pelicans. Sabonis has never lost a game to Anthony Davis.
That's an unbelievable stat. Even though I don't like, you know, the NBA is not a one-on-one kind of game. It's still incredible.
Yeah.
Would have to play the loser of that game on the road to get to the eighth seed to play either Denver, Minnesota, or OKC in round one. Like, that is a tough path to making a legitimate playoff push. And I know Miami did it last year, but I don't know, man.
I'd say not
feeling great about their
chances. If the Thunder are the one seed, I think there's a path there for the Lakers to get to the second round, just from a matchups perspective, not of any, like, not believing in the Thunder, but just from a matchup perspective. But that's just, I agree with you that there's too many things you need to line up there to even get out of the first round, let alone get back to the conference finals or have a shot at the finals.
Yeah.
The Warriors, last time we talked about them, the surging Rockets had them on the ropes. They were barely clinging to 10th. They responded by reeling off five straight wins, including four straight on the road, and a really important one at home against the Mavs on Tuesday. Draymond looks great when he's not getting ejected. They play at Houston tonight. So depending on when you listen to this, obviously this could be a bit old, but obviously a mammoth game in the Western Conference play-in race. Here's the thing, though. Maybe it's not, because the Warriors have three games left against Utah and Portland. Two against the Jazz, one against the Blazers. Those should be fairly routine wins this time of year. If you look at the lineups, those teams, already bad teams, are trotting out there and they're not too interested in winning. So even if the Rockets beat the Warriors in this matchup tonight, their lone remaining matchup, and even if the Warriors lose their other three games against winning teams, so they only beat the Jazz and the Blazers to finish the season, that means they would finish 3-4. That means they would finish 44-38, but they've already clinched the season series against Houston, which means most likely Houston's going to have to win 45 games to get into the play-in, and that literally requires the Rockets to win out. So all of which is to say is, as mammoth as this Warriors-Rockets game tonight feels, and obviously in order to win out, they need to beat the Warriors, so it is big. It might not be as big as people think simply because of the way the schedule breaks down. I think the Warriors might just hold on to this by default, but still obviously a big game. I'm probably more confident in the Lakers.
I don't know. It just doesn't, like, basically where we're at is only one of those teams is even emerging from the first play-in round at this stage. So yeah, we can talk about paths, I guess, but it's not going to be easy for either of them to even make it into the playoffs proper. They're both going to have a real challenge in front of them, starting with having to face off with one another, with only one of them advancing, just to get to the next stage of the play-in to play a very difficult opponent, whether it is Sacramento, whether it is New Orleans, or whether it is Phoenix. Or whether it is Dallas. Dallas is only half a game out of the play-in. Like, it's just not, it's not going to be easy for either of these teams to even get to eight. And so it feels almost pointless to talk about what kind of noise they could make in the playoffs when at most one of them is going to be there and very possibly neither of them will be.
Okay, listen, we have, even for our standards, I think gone longer than we ever have before. So, I've got two questions for you to end it on. And the second question will deal with the team in this race that we haven't actually discussed yet. So, there'll be a way for us to talk about them. But my first question is, now that we've talked Clippers, Mavs, Suns, Pelicans, Kings, Lakers, Warriors, who's the fourth best team in the West? The same way we asked who's the second best team in the East, who is the fourth best team in the West?
I think it's Dallas. That's who I'm giving it on to.
If you would have asked me this a week ago, I might have actually said New Orleans.
That's the thing about this version of the Western Conference. It's like a Rubik's Cube that's just like changing all the time. But like, again, outside of that top three that's just been consistently excellent all year, But yeah, on a given day, it could be Dallas, could be the Clippers, could be Phoenix, could be New Orleans. Sacramento in this state with those guys out, I don't think qualifies. But yeah, I think it's probably one of the Clippers, Mavs, Suns, or Pelicans.
Nice.
And if you're asking me right now who's playing the best of those teams, then I think it's clearly Dallas.
All right. My second question, and this will be our, I guess, our way to get out of here and deal with the last team we haven't talked about yet, is about the Houston Rockets. So, look, all in all, even if they don't finish this improbable run by actually stealing that 10th seed, and I've already explained why I don't think they will, the season was still a success for the Rockets. It's exactly what they wanted in terms of, you know, they brought the adults into the room, they brought in winning vets, and they moved to the phase of the rebuild where they're actually trying to win, they're competitive, they're in the race pretty much all year, they have a good chance of actually having a winning season, and it's just that the West is a bloodbath, and that's what it is. But when you look at this recent run that has propelled them back into the race, when you look at the Jalen Green breakout, which we've talked a little bit about already a few weeks ago, but when you look at the way Jalen Green's played and the way things have coalesced for them the last month or so, is there anything in your mind to read into with respect to the fact that this all happened without Alperen Şengün? Or do you think it is just kind of the way things happened? You don't think it's indicative of anything about the way the team is built or the way they need to build or the future? And it's just, that's the way the chips fell for whatever reason. But it's exciting that Jalen Green is having this breakout and can now combine with Alperen Şengün, who is still by far their most promising and best young player. Or do you think there's something there that maybe they found something without Şengün that does tell you a little bit maybe about a ceiling with him? I don't know. Talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the question might be actually less about Jalen Green and more about Amen Thompson. And like what he has been able to do basically playing center on offense since Şengün went out, and whether you can synergize those two guys, whether they can fit together, like that feels like the more interesting question to me, because I do think there are questions that need to be answered about, can you bottle this version of Jalen Green, bring that same version back next year, plop him next to Şengün, and have them figure out how to play off of each other in a more productive way than they were before Şengün got hurt. Because, I mean, the most interesting aspect of this to me is, like, they were a bottom 10, sometimes even bottom 5 offense this season. And since the beginning of March, which is, like, when they started this run, they've gone 13-3 since then. That's when Jalen Green's run started, basically. Right exactly when March started is when he started to go off. And Şengün was healthy for at least a couple of those games, but mostly it's been without him. They're third in the league in offense. And it's interesting that they're basically their offensive fulcrum, who has been, you know, terrific as like a high post operator, a playmaker, a post scorer all year. He goes down and suddenly it's a completely different looking offense that has been a whole lot more effective with more 3-point shooting and more pace and a completely different Jalen Green. The thing, like, on that front, I guess, that I'm going to be paying attention to is, like, the idea of Green being the super dynamic off guard never really came to fruition. He didn't figure out ever, I don't think, like, the balance of aggression and deference, where, like, he would just kind of fade into the background a lot of the time. I wrote about him earlier this season. At that time, he had an 11% usage rate in crunch time. He was just not involved, not a factor. And it is hard to believe that that is the same dude that you now see completely taking control of games at the offensive end, close games, whatever. The ball is in his hands, and he is confidently making plays for himself and for others. Like, and there's certain stuff that I just can't really explain by the fact that Şengün isn't there. Like, you could say that it's opened up the floor, but I don't know. Like, is Amen Thompson really doing much more to space the floor than Şengün was? Like, that doesn't explain to me why a guy who was at, like, mid-50s percent in finishing at the rim until, like, after the All-Star break has since then been shooting 72% at the rim with, like, some unbelievable finishes when he is, like, going right at rim protectors, including Rudy Gobert twice in their game the other night, taking the bump, hanging in midair, and finishing. And he's doing that a ton. And he's figured out how to split traps as well as almost anybody in the league, although he got ripped doing that twice against Minnesota because maybe like they're starting to sit on that move a little bit. But like all this stuff, especially the playmaking, I think, that he just like wasn't really showing before, he's doing now. And that there's no reason to say like he couldn't have done that with Şengün healthy. But there is an aspect of like mentality that you could say, can this translate when you're being asked to be more of like an off guard and have the ball in your hands probably less? So I don't think it's like perfectly like, yeah, you just plop Şengün there and this Jalen Green will exist. They have to figure that out. But I do think it's like more interesting, like where Amen Thompson fits into that. Like, how does that work with the two of them together? Because offensively, right now, at least like with the state of his jump shot, where it is, it kind of feels like he has to play that role where he is like the nominal offensive five.
And I don't even mean it as like an indictment of Şengün, because I think he's their best player. I think he's their most promising player. And like, I don't think, other than some of the, you know, defensive issues we knew were there, which I think he got better on that end this year, at least a little bit, I don't really think there's something I can point to be like, oh, you can't win with this guy. I also do think some, like when the turnaround is that stark. Yeah, especially with respect to Jalen Green, but maybe it is just kind of what you talked about with him not being the type of player that's ever going to be able to thrive in an off-ball role. But if that's the case, that alone brings its own questions about their future, right? Because if they're all healthy, I still want the ball in Alperen Şengün's hands and the offense running through him as a hub. So I think, look, it for the most part, it's a good problem to have based on the way this trajectory is starting to go for the franchise. But I do think that they've got some questions that need answering based on the way the season ended.
Yeah. And I mean, on top of that, too, like we talked about sort of like ball handling stuff and just the mentality of like staying involved, even if the ball isn't in your hands. But there's the other fact that like Jalen Green just seems more comfortable pulling off of the dribble than off of the catch. Like when I wrote about him, I haven't actually looked this up recently, but when I wrote about him early in the season, he was shooting better on pull-up threes than on catch and shoots. And that's actually fairly consistent with his career up to this point. Like there's something about it where he just seems a little bit more comfortable as the ball handler. So I think it's his contract negotiation. Like he's extension eligible this summer, as is Şengün. And that is just going to be one of the most fascinating negotiations, I think, in the entire league, is like what kind of number, if at all, if they can find some kind of compromise, what kind of number do they land on? Because even with this run, just given the whole body of work to this point, I don't think they can justify maxing him out.
No. Jalen Green? No. No way.
And I, you know, before this stretch without Şengün and showing how it's unlocked Jalen Green and Amen Thompson and like showing that the team can be really successful without him, before that, I would have said, absolutely, you just give Şengün the max. I wonder how this run without him changes that calculus as well. Like, it's going to be a really interesting offseason for them.
Yep. I will say, Jalen Green fans would tell you the reason he's a better pull-up shooter than catch-and-shoot shooters because he's a hooper's hooper.
I mean, look, the amount of separation that he creates on his step-backs is sometimes jaw-dropping. Like, it's so tantalizing. That's the thing. Like watching him put all this together after seeing all of those tantalizing signs not come to fruition, not result in anything in terms of his productivity, anything exceptional, seeing it all come together now is like very exciting. And so because of that, I think it's easier to say, oh yeah, he's figured it out. You max him out. He just is this guy now. And I don't know if it's quite that simple, but I would like to believe that it is because he's been amazing to watch these last few weeks.
No argument there. What is so simple is the fact that I think we got to get the hell out of here. what do you say about that?
I guess. Yeah, I could stay here talking about this shit all day, as you know. But
oh, I'm with you there, partner. But
I hope for our listeners' sakes that they are able to listen to this on like 1.5 speed so it doesn't actually take them, you know, the equivalent of a Marvel movie in running time to get through it. But it's been a joy. This is what happens when we miss a week. We got a lot to catch up on.
Yeah, this has been Pound the Rock, brought to you by Martin Scorsese. All right. I know we've done this a couple times recently, but let's get back to fan shoutouts next week. No more breaks for us until most likely the off season. So you can expect us weekly again, barring anything unforeseen. So we'll talk to you next week. For Joe Wolfman, I'm Joseph Cusciaro. Pound the Rock.